Thinking about self-publishing and don't know where to start? Join the Spa Girls each week for a fun-filled podcast filled with honest advice, tips, and resources. Lots of filling in that new intro. never mind.
I'm Shah Barrett.
I'm Cheryl Phipps.
And I'm Wendy Vella.
And today we have an awesome guest. She's a second-time guest for us, but Helen Scheurer.
Hey, Helen.
Nice work on back. The name pronunciation. Yes.
Thanks for having me back, guys.
So Helen's going to talk to us about writing in series, which she's very experienced at. But first, I'm just going to read your bio out, and then we'll get right into the actual interview. So Helen Scheurer is the YAR fantasy author of the best-selling series, Oromeri Chronicles. Is that
Oromeri?
Oromeri Chronicles and the Curse of Siren Queen Quartet. Her work has been highly praised for its strong, flawed female characters and its action-packed plots. Her books often have been likened to Sarah J. Maas's Throne of Glass series and the epic girl power film Wonder Woman. Helen's love of writing and books led her to pursue a Bachelor of Creative Writing, majoring at the University of Wollongong, and a Master's of Publishing at the University of Sydney. Now a full-time author, Helen lives amidst the mountains in New Zealand and is constantly dreaming up new stories. Okay, so that's awesome. So you've done all this university-style education. We learned about that in the last time you were on the show. Mm-hmm. So if anyone wants to go and listen to that, it is episode number 282 from March 2021. So...
Woohoo!
So long ago. We were just saying how it feels like it's 10 years, even though it's just over a year since we spoke to you last time.
Yeah, definitely.
So let's talk about what you've been up to quickly in the time since the last interview, and then we'll get right into the details of writing in series.
Okay, sure. Last year I spoke to you. So I think I was on the cusp of releasing the first book in a new series. Mm-hmm. So that has since come out. The first book, A Layer of Bones, came out in July, just after I spoke to you guys. Then the second book came out in November, and the third book came out maybe about 3 weeks ago. Yeah, so that's the three out of the four books in the Curse of the Siren Queen quartet. So been pretty busy since I spoke to you guys. Definitely sort of changed my sort of production schedule and how I do things. I think, you know, as you go through your career, it naturally changes and progresses and stuff. Yeah. So, yeah, lots happening, really. And then I also somewhere in there wrote a nonfiction book, which is why I'm on today.
and that's awesome. So, and that was How to Write a Successful Series. Mm-hmm. So that's what we're talking about today. So let's start right from the very beginning on that one. What is a series? Like how do you define series for you?
So my nonfiction book focuses more on series that are a series of connected novels. So, I mean, it can be interconnected standalones, but my book is more so about dynamic series. So series that have the same characters and the same storyline across many books. Mm-hmm. The book does talk about, so the different types, so that's a dynamic series. There's a static series as well, which is sort of a bit more episodic, or it follows like the same character, but maybe say, for example, a detective might have a different case per book rather than an overarching case across many books. So that's sort of how I define it at the beginning of the book.
Would you include books that are, say, for example, in the same setting? Like, you know, for often romance, it's like two different main characters, but they're in the same town or something like that. So that's a series in your...
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I think because my experience is more in that dynamic sort of area, you know, it's fantasy. It follows a cast of characters across epic journeys and stuff. But I would definitely... still refer to, say, a romance series like Bridgerton, for instance, that while that covers a different couple per book or in the Netflix series per season, it's still a series. So I do sort of talk a lot about that in terms of second generation series, literary universes, just sort of all of these things that you can take from a book and put them into other books and bring them all together and have these common threads throughout them, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what are the benefits then? Like if we want, why would we write a series versus writing standalones?
So this is something that I think I very much had to learn myself in practice along the way. It's not something that I set out to do. I didn't sit down one day and go, I'm going to write a series because it's more lucrative or because it might make my job easier down the line. But I think in doing the writing of the series, I realized both those things. For me, it's definitely been more lucrative to, because you basically, when you write the first book, you're building an audience, you're building a platform for that. And so then if you write a completely different book the next time round and not following on from that, then you've got to do that all again. Mm-hmm. And you've got to launch that to a new audience again. Whereas what I found with both my series is you do that groundwork up front, but then you get to use it to your advantage throughout the rest of the series. So you've got this inbuilt audience who are there waiting for that next book rather than having to market a different book to a different audience and try and maybe bring people across to the next thing that you're doing that's not completely related to the first one, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So that's one thing. I think that's in terms of it being lucrative in that, you know, you're making the most of the audience that you have. I think it's also easier to get a higher ROI on advertising when you've got a series. And also for me, especially with fantasy, you are doing all this huge world building. You've got a big cast of characters, and then you've done all that groundwork in terms of the writing and the brainstorming, and for me, outlining as well. And so, when I get to the second and the third and the fourth book in the series, I know that world so well, and I know those characters so well that the work that I'm doing doesn't feel as heavy lifting as it does with that first book. And I think that then lends itself to being more productive, feeling better about your work, you know, and also being able to improve your writing as well, because you are constantly referring back to this world, delving deeper and deeper into these characters, because they do have to sustain multiple books.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I think on so many levels, there are so many different benefits to writing in a series.
Mm, yeah, 100%.
Have you decided how many books is you know, a good amount?
I think that really depends on the genre and the audience that you've built up throughout your career. I don't think there's a number of books that is like, this is the best number in a series to write. My sort of approach to the number of books in a series, I guess, has changed over the last 5 years or so. So when I wrote my first series, The Oromia Chronicles, I decided that was going to be a trilogy from the start. But that wasn't necessarily a super informed decision. It was that I write fantasy, there's a lot of trilogies in fantasy, I'll give that a crack, sort of thing. And then the second series that I've done is a quartet, and that was me thinking, well, I'll try my hands at just a little bit longer, just a little bit longer. And then, yeah, so now I'm actually in the middle of sort of brainstorming and outlining for a brand new series. And I've found that I don't want to contain myself to saying, you know, this is going to be a 5-book series, a 6-book series. And that's because of a lot of the lessons I've learned along the way. And mainly it's because I find that, so I've just released the third book in my most recent series out of 4. And it's starting to gain momentum. And I'm so familiar with that world, and I kind of didn't want to leave it. Mm-hmm. And I'd said from the beginning that it was 4 books, and I had planned it as 4 books. So that's ended, but well, it will end at the end of this year. But I just thought to myself when I was planning for the new series that I didn't want to constrain myself. Yeah. But I mean, I talk about in the nonfiction book having expansion and exit strategies for when you're writing series. And that that's sort of at the back of my mind. And all I mean by that is, you know, having a sort of plan B in case things either go really badly or really well. So mm-hmm. I don't want to plan a 9-book series and then, you know, 3 books in, it's just not doing well. And I've committed the next, you know, 5 years of my life to writing it. So having things throughout the series that, you know, I could potentially just add one more book and wrap it up. Mm-hmm. Or if it goes incredibly well, then expanding on that. So mm-hmm. It's been a really interesting process writing this nonfiction book just for my own fiction and sort of analyzing the little choices that you make along the way and how impactful they can be further down the road.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, because if you have an overarching theme to the book and you can wrap it up in 4 books, you can't potentially drag it out for another couple. But maybe somewhere in there you could start another
thread. Exactly.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Mm. That's cool. And how long are your books, just out of curiosity?
So they average around 115,000 to 120,000-odd. So they're chunky books, yeah.
Oh, you cracked me up. So, and that makes a lot of sense. I mean, not even just something like not naming it a quartet from the beginning, just saying it's a series.
Yes, lesson learned.
That might, you know, and give yourself that leeway. Because I do know other authors who kind of started a series thinking it's going to be one length and then it becomes really popular and suddenly it becomes much longer, you know.
I mean, and that's not to say, like, just because I've said it's a quartet that I couldn't extend it. I could if I wanted to. I think for me, I've told the story that I set out to tell, and I'm also eager to get onto this next thing and sort of implement all the lessons that I've learned with series 1 and 2 into series 3. And, you know, I guess that's always our goal, is just to keep getting better and better. So that's the idea.
So series 3, is it linked in any way to the other 2 series, or is it?
Yeah. So this is also something I talk about in the nonfiction book, is literary universes. So my first 2 series are set in the same universe, and that's not saying that, you know, major characters from series 1 show up in series 2, but there are breadcrumbs from series 1 that come into series 2 that if you're a long-term reader of mine, you'll pick those up, and it's sort of like little rewards for readers throughout. And I've had several readers contact me being like, oh my god, this is this from that, and, you know, making the connections is really rewarding for them. And also it builds on that idea of, like, I've already done the groundwork, I had a magic system, I had the type of, like, feel for the worlds. And with my first series, I called the map, for example, what did I call it? Upper Realm. And then the second series is the Lower Realm. And then the series that I have next might be the Mid Realm. Yeah. And I think all of that is, like, it's pretty vague, but it doesn't matter. And it's vague enough that you can keep adding to it and it doesn't cause any issues. And you just, I think, building and building upon the same world in multiple series just makes each individual series all the more richer.
And Jennifer Lynn Barnes talks about this. She talks about the in fandom, like those little breadcrumbs that you're talking about, like the character being in one series and then someone, a reader being able, you know, like a dedicated reader being able to spot something from one series in the next one. It gives them a buzz, a thrill, and something to kind of go, ooh.
I started doing that with sort of a bit later in my series. And so I bring all of the characters from each series. I'll throw one into each, you know, and people love it. I get people saying to me all the time, I met the so-and-so in there, and that, you know, they love it. It's just like meeting an old friend again.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's something that that romance authors do really well, is that, like, their first book in the series might focus on one couple. But in getting to know that couple, we might get to know someone's brother, and then that brother becomes the main character of the next one. And, I mean, that works incredibly well in romance. I mean, you just need to look at Bridgerton, really.
And it's because we're connected to that cast of characters and we want to see them again. And that's,
exactly. And that's another benefit to writing in a series, is that, I mean, I know me as a reader, sometimes, like, the decision fatigue of trying to find something new to read is, you know, it just gets a bit much. There's so many options. Whereas if there's a series whose characters I love, whose world I love, like, I'm eager to go back there and get to know more characters in that world. And it seems less daunting because I'm already sort of familiar.
And you know that you're going to like it, right? I think that's as a reader, we're kind of, for me anyway, I'm like, oh, trying a new author, trying a new book. It's always like that, oh, am I going to like it? Whereas if you're delving back into a series that you already know you like with characters that you know you like, then
there's nothing more exciting than picking up a book and reading it and thinking, oh, wow, there's another five of these. Yes, you know, exactly. I'm just loving it.
Exactly. You know, it goes back to the whole sort of binge culture. Like, we love a good binge. And I think it's the same with reading. And it is that comfort of returning to the same world and returning to those characters that, you know, makes us feel good about ourselves.
Yeah, 100%. Do you have any series aside from your own that, like, your favorite ones that you kind of think epitomize the best series ever?
That's a big question.
Sorry.
Well, funnily enough, like, and this is not, I've never read the comics, but the Marvel universe is that, to me, I think that might have been ticking away at the back of my head as I was sort of coming up with the idea for the nonfiction book. But I think that is one of the best examples of having individual series. So you've got, you know, the Thor series, you've got Iron Man, you've got Spider-Man, but, you know, having these breadcrumbs throughout and bringing them all together, and then the big Avenger movies. Like, I, over the first New Zealand lockdown, my partner and I watched from, like, in chronological order from the beginning of Marvel to the end. And by the end, I was so emotionally invested. I was crying by the end of it. I was dreaming about it. And I think that is the sign of a good series, is that, you know, that you just get so invested in it. Yeah. I think that's a great example. I mean, I read a lot of fantasy. So, you know, Harry Potter, Throne of Glass, the Red Wall books by Brian Jacques, I think. They were meant to be children's books, but I don't think they were really kids' books. But, just anything that gets you invested in those characters and the story. I think they're some of my favourites. Anyway, before I, like, go on a big tangent about it, I'll just leave it there. They're some of my favourites.
That's cool. Awesome. If we're talking about, so let's delve into the writing of the series. Let's talk about how that works for you and where you start and what. So there must be sort of things that you've learned doing your first two series that kind of that you can get. I want to start at the beginning. Okay, let's just start. What do you do when you write? You're thinking about writing a new series. Like, what are you doing at the moment with this new series in terms of planning?
Okay, so my approach right now is quite different to what it was when I did Heart of Mist, which was the first book in my first series. So for that, I didn't do overly much planning. I did it for a NaNoWriMo, I think, in 2016, and then went full steam ahead with then going to publish it. And I didn't really start writing or thinking too deeply about writing the second book until that first book was already out, That worked for me at the time. Like, it was also me easing my way into indie publishing and the industry. So that was fine for then. But I think, you know, I'm nearly 5 years into my career as a full-time author now. And I've realized in writing the first series and the second series that I need to be more strategic about my approach to the series, about the choices that I make very early on. Because, you know, if you don't think about these things, you kind of can put yourself into plot holes later, or, you know, you've ended up with a book that you love, but maybe it's not the most marketable, or maybe you can't get ads for it, or, you know. So how I'm sort of approaching this series, and this, again, this is not the best way for everybody, it's just how I do it. I've started this time round by really trying to identify comp titles, by doing a lot of reading in the genre. I've looked at the Kaylytics reports for a couple of the genres that I'm thinking of going into. So I'm definitely sticking with fantasy. I am starting to think maybe I veer more into romantic fantasy. So that's a bit of a learning curve for me, because my previous books, they've got romantic subplots, but it's not the same as romantic fantasy. So I start with a lot of research, basically. Yeah. And then once I've done that, I've been thinking about the characters and the world, because it is set in the same universe. You know, there are certain things I can bring from the previous two series, like the feel, the sort of general rules of magic, I suppose. One thing I like to do is bring like magical creatures from the first and second series. And so there's like a general awareness of these types of creatures. And that's one thing that links everything. But so I do a lot of research. I do a lot of reading. And pretty much the last month I have been brainstorming. So brainstorming and reading. I've read Romancing the Beat. What else have I read? I've read a bunch of like nonfiction books to sort of kickstart my own ideas, really. So lots of brainstorming, really. And it's one of those weird ones because it's a lesson I have to keep teaching myself that the brainstorming session is work. And it doesn't feel like work. It feels like I'm sitting here on Pinterest. It feels like I'm sitting here reading a fantasy book. But it is so, so vital to do that groundwork, for me anyway, before I start, because I'll find further down the line I could be, you know, halfway through a book of writing a book and then get stuck because I hadn't thought of something, or I've worked myself into a hole, or I didn't fully understand the reader expectation or something like that. So this is like quite a new part to my process, is this huge part of brainstorming. And I've been doing it for maybe 3 weeks or so. And I've slowly started to outline. So I've got a really fun spreadsheet that is like the first potentially 6 books in this series. And every time I get an idea for a later book, I just throw it in to whatever relevant sheet it's in. And I use an outline template from Derek Murphy. I think it's called the one-page novel outline. And for me, I really like structure. And so it really helps me to have sort of the beats of the story down, and then I can build around that. So that's sort of where I'm at. I've nearly finished roughly outlining the first book, and I am constantly thinking about where the next couple of books are going to go, and also what I can take from the plans from the later books to weave into the first book, because I think particularly with a dynamic series, you want to have those threads throughout. And then at the end you bring it all together. And I think if you don't do that, you know, you lose some of the magic of a series, I think. So that's how I'm approaching it. And then once I've got the draft, like the outline of the draft, I'll attempt to fast draft it, because I tend to do quite skeletal drafts and, you know, layer in the character development, the world building and stuff as I edit or rework the book. I just need to get it out of my head first. So that's how I'm approaching book one of a new series at the moment anyway.
Yeah, that's cool.
Good.
That's
awesome. And I think it's important, like you're saying, I've heard the term percolating as well, which is probably implies a bit more thinking about it, like the pre-thinking, if you like, before you start writing, about the actual brainstorming. I think I like that word better, because it kind of, like, brainstorming is a cool word. It's storming and it's active. But it's part of the work as well.
Yeah, exactly. And you're right with percolating, because I find, like, once you sort of immerse yourself into this part of the process, you'll get ideas. Like, you're thinking about it even when you're not thinking about it. And, you know, you might be in the middle of cooking dinner, or you might be folding the washing, and then I'll have to stop and run to my office and write something down. And that is the really exciting part, where it starts to snowball, I think, in your mind. And that's because you have been percolating the ideas.
Yeah. And often those thoughts come when we're doing something that's not actually sitting at the keyboard or sitting with a pen and paper. It's often doing something where our brain is allowed to float away and think.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. The dishes.
Yeah.
When you should be sleeping.
Yes, that happens too, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So at this stage, are you trying to think of like the hooks and the things that are, you know, you talked about the breadcrumbs going through, but that kind of thing, the things that are going to make this a compelling series? Is that how you?
Yeah, definitely. So where I'm at currently, one of the things on my list for this week is to really develop the hook that happens at the end of the first book that leads into the second. Because from my experience when I did Oromir, I think we all have a basic understanding of the devices that, you know, go into a series. We know you have something at the end to make you want the next installment. But when I was writing Oromir, I did do that stuff sort of subconsciously, but none of the things that I did were these huge deliberate choices. And I think as I've gone through my career, I've gotten better at making these deliberate choices and being more strategic and understanding, you know, the difference between a cliffhanger and a soft cliffhanger, or an open loop and breadcrumbs, and all these sort of like really cool terminologies that, you know, are the things that bring you from one installment to the next. And I've become a lot more strategic about that. So in the outlining stage, I am coming up with the open loops that, you know, we might get a resolution from open loop one from book one to two, but then there's another open loop that might take us from book one to three. And you just bringing these threads across. I'm talking a lot with my hands now.
Right. We're all hand talkers here.
Yeah. So I am very consciously coming up with these things to weave throughout. And I think one of the biggest things is that sort of that punch at the end of book one to bring people over to the next one. And that's not necessarily a hard cliffhanger, but you have to have these things that it's basically unanswered questions that you want your readers to go, well, what happens next? I need to know.
So can you give us some examples from your books of an open loop and maybe a really good cliffhanger that without giving it away, but
from your books.
Yeah, I suddenly thought, oh, maybe that's not
that's a tricky one without being too spoilery.
Maybe from another book that she's written. Okay. Would be better.
So I guess for an open loop, a question could be, will Harry defeat Voldemort? Yeah. And we get that throughout seven books. And I mean, we have the smaller battles, but the overall war of will he defeat Voldemort is a big unanswered question, a big open loop that we don't get the resolution of until that final book. Cliffhangers is an interesting one because I don't want to spoil movies and books for people, really.
You can say the cliffhanger
So the term cliffhanger comes from, and I can't remember the it was a serial in a newspaper in Victorian era, and it was a story, and the story, one of the episodes ends with a person literally hanging by their fingertips on the edge of a cliff, and that's how it is.
It's a cliffhanger
That's a cliffhanger. And in my book, How to Write a Successful Series, I talk about the difference between hard cliffhangers and soft cliffhangers. Mm-hmm. So that is a hard cliffhanger. Will they, won't they survive sort of thing. Whereas for soft cliffhangers, maybe it's more of a question that hangs at the end, but that you still have a complete experience with the book. So Harry Potter, for instance, the Philosopher's Stone, you know, they have the battle or whatever with Quirrell, and Harry defeats him at the end, but then there's sort of this question like, he's going to come back. Will he come back? And that's sort of more of a soft cliffhanger. That's probably not the best example, but there is a difference between literally leaving your reader hanging on the edge of a cliff, because that can be unsatisfying to some people. And I think these things also depend on the author's release schedule. I think, you know, if you're doing a more rapid release, you can probably get away with that. And the thing is that cliffhangers do make your read-through rate skyrocket, and that is why people use them. But for me, I don't publish that frequently. So my first series came out one book per year, and then this next series, I think I've had two come out last year, and then I'll have two come out this year. So there's still like 6 months or so between each book. So I'm not overly comfortable leaving people on a cliffhanger that then has the book like unresolved. So I still want each book to be contained. I still want the reader to have a satisfying story arc, but then it's a matter of introducing something else. So you get your whole complete arc, and then you get introduced something, another question right at the end. And I go, I really want to know that now. Yeah. I forget what we're talking about now, but
you could kind of almost say that a soft cliffhanger is an open loop almost.
Yeah. Same. I think it's a form of open loop. Sure.
Yeah. Okay. So it's all about making the reader want to go on to the next book, right? Like
absolutely
kind of a solid ending or a more fluid ending where you need to get the next book. It's all about that read through, and the, which is one of the great things about series, right? And so it's almost definitely. Like if you didn't have some form of cliffhanger, it would almost make no sense in a series.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, absolutely. You need those unanswered questions. You need that sort of mystery to keep the reader invested. And I mean, in romance, that could be, will they, won't they get together? You know, will this person defeat the evil lord sort of thing? And you can have self-contained stories in the individual books, but I guess the thing about series is that you'll have a story arc for each book, but you'll have an overarching series arc. Mm-hmm. And the breadcrumbs, the cliffhangers, the open loops are all contributing to that series arc and basically holding the reader's hand throughout the series.
Is a breadcrumb anything to do with this, like the unanswered questions, or is it just a matter of kind of putting something in there so that readers can feel like they've picked up on something and are closer to that? Or what do you think that's?
For me, open loops are the unanswered questions, the posing of the questions throughout the series that brings the reader along. For me, a breadcrumb is like basically the Hansel and Gretel analogy, where you know you're just sprinkling these little clues, and it might be a clue to something big, it could be a clue to something small. For me, I do it over the course of my two series so far. So what I was saying before, you know, I might have a magical creature from series one appear in series two, and that sort of is to the reader, they're like, oh yeah, I remember that, and they might know something about that creature that the current characters in the new series don't know. Mm-hmm. And it's just, yeah, it's just sort of, for me, the breadcrumbs can be much smaller things. They can contribute to big or small things, really. And it is just about rewarding that reader. It's about sort of kind of guiding them through the story and, like, yeah, rewarding them as they go, I think, because you do need to do that throughout the series. Your readers are investing in not one book, but, you know, potentially 5, 9, whatever, however many books. So you do want to satisfy them along the way, all the while still creating that mystery, creating those questions that they need to know the answers to.
Yeah. There's something about the breadcrumbs that makes me think it's like a flash of recognition. And it's like that, like for me, it feels like, you know, when you see something that you remember from childhood and you go, oh my God, that's the thing that we used to do. Yeah. And you love it. Yeah. Like you just because it was something you used to do, even if it's not that amazing. You know, like maybe recognizing the magical creature in the second series that you remember.
It's a little warm fuzzy.
Yeah, it gives you
exactly,
fuzzy,
exactly.
Yeah.
And I mean, for me, like, for example, in my Curse of the Siren Queen series, like, there's so many different ways you can use it. So one of the things that I do, it's maybe not so much a breadcrumb, but like an open loop, for the prologues for each of the Curse of the Siren Queen books, they're from the perspective of the main character's mother. And that's the only time you ever get her perspective is in the prologue of each of the books. But it opens with her in a prison, and she's given birth in a prison. And this is sounding real dark and twisty right from the beginning, isn't it? But so as the series progresses, each prologue from each book answers a couple of more questions of like how she ended up in there, how long she's been in there, why is she in there? Mm-hmm. And so that is an open loop across the four books. And another maybe sort of more breadcrumb sort of thing is there in that prologue, the mum sings a lullaby to the main character as an infant. And then throughout the four books, that lullaby comes up and you start to learn, is it a lullaby? Is it something else? Does it have more power? You know, all that kind of thing. And so that, you know, that'll come to her, that lullaby, in the middle of other things. And you know, it is the question, like, what is this and how is it relevant? When then, you know, the longer it goes on and more we learn about it, the more impactful it becomes.
Yeah.
Very impressed with your brain at this point.
Yeah. My head's actually hurting.
Something that struggles to get to 60,000 words in a single hour. So it's going over ground that you've already covered just a little bit, but just to clarify, you would work on the series arc first before you break it down into the individual books, or does it come from the books and then goes up a level, if you like, an overarching level?
I think it's sort of interlinked, really. Like, you know, you'll get an idea for one thing and that will kickstart ideas for other things. For me, I generally get the series arc first, and it might not be a super developed arc. It might just be, you know, that in a darkening world, there's a greater evil that has to be overcome, which is like every fantasy book ever. So it doesn't have to be this like huge original thing. But I think, you know, determining your series arc allows you to then figure out what you want each individual book and to be and where they sit in the arc. So in my nonfiction book, I've got actual diagrams of how I sort of set up a series, and basically it's a line across the top of a page, and that's your series arc. You just put a sentence, and then you have like the books beneath it, and how do they fit into that story, if that makes sense. And what, because each book, while for me a book in a series still has to contain its own story, it still has to be satisfying to the reader, but it also has to build towards the conclusion of the series arc. So that sort of starting point for me is working out how the books fit into the into the series arc and how they build towards that, you know, big epic conclusion at the end. But I mean, that's just how I do it. In writing this book, I did talk to some discovery writers, because I'm quite a rigid person. I like outlining, and if I can't see where I'm going, I can't get there. Whereas I've talked to David Estes and Crystal Shannon in this book, who are like these incredible series writers, but who discovery write, which to me was such a foreign concept. And some of the techniques that they talk about in, you know, avoiding plot holes and stuff, because they're obviously just writing as they go. You know, my main concern would be, well, what if I write, you know, 200,000 words and I realize that I haven't done this, or that I needed to do something to set this big thing up. And but just some of the techniques that they use are really, really interesting as well. Like, they keep notes along the way, or as they're writing, they also keep like a post-it note wall of outline next to them, so they always know what's going on. It's really incredible how different everybody's mind works. And it, like, I found it really inspiring talking to them, because to me, I was like, oh my God, it's a whole new world.
I think it's awesome that you covered both sides of your, like, it's almost like sort of left brain, right brain approach to, you know, I mean, nothing's black and white, but yeah, it is. Yeah, it's always interesting finding out how the other half works.
Exactly.
Well, you talk to Wendy. I mean, she's a discovery writer, if you're going to use that terminology.
And I like that.
Yeah.
It's
a bit different to pencil, isn't it?
Yeah. It actually sounds less judgy, eh? Yeah.
It does. I like it. I'm going to be a discovery writer. Yeah, I'm a discovery writer.
Yeah.
Nice.
I'm just listening to you speaking, though, Helen, I'm just like almost breaking out in a rash with all that plotting and planning. And
Yeah, I'm very, like, particular with that, and I know that that's my personal method. It's definitely not like that for everybody, but for me,
it has to happen at some stage. Like, Wendy will just write the story, but then she has to go back and edit, and she has a particular thing. Like, she will cut 20,000 to 30,000 words.
Like, to tell everyone casually
just, well, it makes my little heart thud, like, every time you talk casually about cutting 30,000 words. But that's your process, right? Like, that's
write more, cut, and then edit.
Anyway, sorry to interrupt you, Helen.
No, you're right.
Okay, so what are some of the, do you have any other tips and tricks that you can sort of talk to us about through the process of writing the series? Like, maybe a series Bible? Do you keep series Bible?
Oh, yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. That's a huge chunk of my book, actually. I've come to really appreciate the benefits of using a series Bible. And I mean, I think a lot of people think, oh, well, of course, because you write fantasy. I think even if I wrote a different genre, I would need it, particularly with series. Like, you're dealing with characters who undergo a metamorphosis from book one to book five. They change. You know, you might need just to remember the layout of a small town. I can't keep all that stuff in my head. So for me, having a series Bible has really saved me a lot of time and a lot of heartache. I didn't keep one for the Oromia Chronicles, and that made things very difficult. You know, like I said, these books are 120,000 words long. Mm. Oromia Chronicles was also four points of view, spanning multiple continents. Like, it was this big epic quest. Yeah, exactly. And so I got to writing the third book and I was like, oh, I can't even remember what type of magic this person has. And, oh, I can't remember the, you know, the seasonal changes of this particular continent. And I mean, I was lucky that I had beta readers who were with me from the beginning of that series, and they're actually still with me now, but having the same beta readers across a series is massively helpful as well. Mm-hmm. But then when it came to writing Curse of the Siren Queen, I thought, I need to avoid that headache. And it is like complicated with magic systems and a, you know, completely fantasy-based world. So, yeah, I kept a series Bible. And I don't mean that, you know, I sat down one day and wrote a series Bible. For me, a series Bible is a working document. So anytime I make a decision about what's going into my series, then I put it in the series Bible. So, you know, my series Bible started off as a blank document. And by the fourth book, it's now 65 pages long. But I never sat down to create that. And it was never like a big part, a big chunk of work for me, because it would literally be me writing, deciding this character has blue eyes, and then just this person, blue eyes. And then the next time I make a decision, oh, they, you know, they walk with a limp, put limp in, you know, and make sure that it's more about like just saving yourself the time and the hassle of having to check what you've written in the previous 300 pages. So I can control find in my series Bible, find out the spelling of this person's name or what eye color they have or who was their brother again? I can't remember. And, you know, that it just makes it, it makes the process so much more streamlined. And also I've found that also working with beta readers and editors, they might come back to me with questions, or maybe I have been inconsistent at some point. At the beginning, someone had blonde hair. At the end, they had brown hair. I don't remember that happening. So, you know, go back to the source material. Where did I make that decision? What was it? Fix it. The series Bible is also something that sometimes I give my editor, because it's got all the spellings for, you know, particularly fantasy names, magical creatures, all that kind of stuff. I can give that to her as a style guide, as opposed to her having to work out which preferred spelling of this made-up name that I've got. So, yeah, but I do want to sort of stress that it's not just beneficial for fantasy. I think, you know, we were talking about romance before and having a big family tree of brothers that are each have their own romance in a book. Having a series Bible, it doesn't have to be 65 pages long. Your series Bible could just be a family tree, or it could be just physical descriptions. It could be a list of places in a particular town. I think it's just about making things as streamlined and easy as possible for yourself, because, you know, writing a series is a big undertaking. So why wouldn't you make things as easy as you can for yourself?
I like that. And it's the organic approach, isn't it? Like you say, just doing it as you're thinking of these things, or as you're writing, just keeping a note on a separate document, separate window, whatever.
Exactly.
Even
a little bit of work. What was the old saying? A little bit of work now saves a whole lot in the future. I don't know. There's some saying around that, but yes.
Are you just doing this in Word, or is it in?
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty old school. I just use Google Docs. Like, I don't even use Scrivener. For me, Scrivener is future Helen's endeavor, because I think it's going to be a bit of a learning curve. I've had a lot of learning curves lately. it is something I want to try, but for the most part, I just use Google Docs for everything, and that works fine. I think for a series Bible, as long as it's searchable, because for me, you know, if I had a 65-page thing printed out, and I'd have to flip through and find what I'm looking for, it kind of defeats the purpose. Yeah. And also, you know, it's backed up. I'm not going to lose it. I think whatever you want to use, as long as it's searchable. Like, I think there are people who use Notion, people who use different apps online, make them look all nice and pretty. Mine is basic, very, very basic. As long as I can control find something, then that's good enough for me.
That's cool.
Good advice.
And I think the idea of doing it as you go, because I've got a couple of series where I haven't done the series Bible, and it's always a massive barrier, the idea of going back to the beginning and having to go through, even though it's quite a lot of work to search through the first book to try and remember.
Definitely. That's something like I really wish I had have done that with Oromia Chronicles, because it's made life so much easier for Curse of the Siren Queen, but also potentially if I ever further down the line decide to revisit those worlds, which I might do that, with Curse of the Siren Queen, there is like I can read the series Bible rather than 420,000 word books. Whereas Oromia Chronicles, I would have to read the books and create a series Bible to refer to. So,
Okay. I like the idea of sending the series Bible to the editor as well. That would actually save everybody a lot of heartache, wouldn't it?
Yeah. I mean, you don't want to overwhelm them because mine is like 65 pages, but, I'll get excerpts from it, especially with the spellings because, like I said, fantasy is quite unique in that department, but it does save everybody a bit of time.
Wow. I'm impressed.
Thank you.
Do you think there's a genre that a series wouldn't work in?
In How to Write a Successful Series, one of the first things I talk about is the resistance to writing series, because I think that is sort of that's a really valid thing to bring up, is like, what if my genre doesn't suit series? I think you can make it work for anything. So I think one of the great things romances do is like the interconnected standalones. So, each book is its own romance and the next book doesn't follow on necessarily with the couple from the first book, but it's still a series because it's set in the same world. It's likely to do with the best friend or the brother or someone of that main couple. And then, you've still got that familiarity. I think if you want to make a series work, you can, regardless of the genre. I mean, maybe literary fiction, not so much, but I think you can still, anything can be an interconnected standalone, and that is still then part of a series. So my feeling is that you can benefit from series no matter what genre you write in, really.
I think we all want to go back to the places we enjoyed being, right? Like, it makes sense.
Yeah, exactly.
And I mean, there's also, I've read series where it's not even about the interconnected people or even the setting that's the same, but it could be a device. For example, a watch or literally a physical device that appears in each of the stories, but doesn't have any connection to the other people, but there's something about that, like you say, about the threads. I think that's such a great I can see the visual of that, the story, like a web almost.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's cool.
Awesome.
There was a question I just had and I've lost it.
So I've got a quick question. I mean, we are coming up to almost letting Helen get back to her hard work, but I just wanted to, I mean, we're not going to go into the depth of marketing and things, but I just wonder if you could talk about, so we've covered from the writer's perspective in terms of staying within the world and just sort of, maybe finding, not that it makes it easier, but just a happy familiarity, if you like, with the world as you're writing books. From a marketing perspective, how does writing a series benefit authors?
So that's a huge question, and I'm probably going to jump around everywhere because, as we were sort of saying before the show started, it's all interlinked. Like the decisions you make in the story with your characters, there are marketing decisions in there, but then there's also marketing decisions with like the branding, the cover, all of that sort of stuff.
And you talked about using Kalytics as well, Helen, right, to trigger you right from the very start when you're
Definitely.
Developing the concept.
Yeah, I do. Nowadays, I do a lot more sort of upfront marketing research than I ever have before. And it's only been recently that I looked at the Epic Fantasy and the Romantic Fantasy Kalytics reports. And they were really helpful just in showing me comp titles that I then wanted to go read and understand the tropes, the reader expectations, all of that, because I wanted to make sure that I was hitting all those things that the readers, when they open your book, that's what they want, that's what they're there for. I definitely do a lot more of that up front. And in terms of what you do as while you're writing, it's making sure that your endings just pack a punch. It's the cliffhangers, yeah. It's the open loops, it's the compelling cast of characters. Are they flawed enough? Are they complex enough to sustain multiple books? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, in doing the genre research, like what tropes, you know, enemies to lovers is a huge one, for example, making sure that you're pulling that trope off correctly, because then later down the line, you're going, read this book, it's got enemies to lovers. And if you don't nail that trope, then you're going to get disappointed readers. You're going to get bad reviews. One thing that I've been talking to some other authors about at the moment as I lean into writing this new series is the importance of that first book. And I talk about that in the nonfiction book as well. And it seems like this super obvious thing, right? Of course, the first book is important. But I don't think I really understood how important that first book was until much later in my career. And I've been quite lucky in how everything's gone. But that first book is setting the rest of your series up for success or failure or whatever it is. And you need to make sure that you're not saving all the good stuff for book three. You want the good stuff in book one, and then you want to make that bigger and better in each book that follows.
Yeah.
And that's something that took me quite a while to understand, like really the kind of mechanics of all of that and how that influences marketing. So one example, like let's stick with Enemies to Lovers. If I am advertising book one, Enemies to Lovers, but they don't become enemies to lovers in that first book, that's a harder sell. Then you're, you know, potentially upsetting readers by promising something that you're not delivering. And so there are all these, it's so interesting. I find it so fascinating, all these decisions that you can be making as you're outlining, drafting, editing, that actually impact your advertising decisions later on, your marketing decisions. You know, maybe you want to do a collaboration with people, and you need to really understand the sort of mechanics of the book that you're writing in terms of marketing in order to pull that off later down the line. Another marketing thing that I think has worked really well for me, and I think we might have talked about this in the last episode that we did together, but reader magnets, particularly with series, work incredibly well. So one thing I did really well with Oromir was, because I had such a big gap in between the full-length novels releasing, was that I wrote short stories set in that world with those characters that were prequels that sort of acted as like a, you know, tying readers over until the next release. So that worked really well. And then at the end of the Oromir books, I offered three novellas for The Curse of the Siren Queen. And it is set in the same world, and it has like those familiar landscape aspects. So in War of Mist, one of the settings that was introduced is a lair of bones. And that is book one of Curse of the Siren Queen. And that is where the first book takes place. So we get a glimpse of that. And then, you know, you close the final page of War of Mist, and then you get three prequel novellas.
Yeah.
You get a new word though. Yeah, I like that.
Prequel. So you get these novellas that are set in this setting that you've already seen a glimpse of. And then after those three novellas comes book one of the new series. And so by that point, you're very familiar with the Lair of Bones that is the main setting of that book. So it's really interesting how something like reader magnets, which, yes, are mainly designed to get people on your mailing list, but also they act as keeping readers engaged in between books, in between series, rewarding those people who have read, you know, the whole series and they really want something else from you just in the meantime until that next book comes out. There's so many like cool strategies. And also while you're writing your series, what I do is I have a separate list of prequel ideas. So as I'm writing the main series and I'll get an idea, this scene could be developed into like, maybe it's a flashback in the main book. That flashback can be a prequel story, and you get that much bigger glimpse into the events that made a character who they are. Maybe that's the reason they're flawed in this way. Maybe it's an emotional wound. And it's, yeah, there's so much you can do. I can talk about it all day, really.
How long are they?
So my prequels range quite a lot. So the first ones I ever did, I think, were only about 4,000 words. Mm-hmm. So just short stories. And then the more recent ones, I think, were maybe about 15,000. But I've never had anybody write back, oh, this is too long or this is too short. They're just happy to be getting something. Yeah. I did find that with the Curse of the Siren Queen ones, which are the longer ones, I really only had it in me to do three, whereas when they were shorter stories, I think in between, before when Heart of Mist came out and when War of Mist came out, those 3 years I wrote nine. And so it was like three before Heart of Mist, three after, then the main book came out, then three more. So, yeah, just sort of keeping the fires burning a little bit. But, yeah, it really didn't matter if it was 4,000 words or 15,000 words. People were just happy. And, like, the first short stories that I did, like, they weren't professionally typeset or anything. Like, I just made PDFs out of them. I think this is before I even used vellum. And I didn't have covers for any of them. And, I mean, nine covers would have been quite a lot. But so with the three Curse of the Siren Queen prequels, which are called Siren Queen Origins, they all had covers designed for them because I was like, there's three of them. And I was working with a bigger agency at the time and they had the ability to link the covers, but so that you can tell that they're all together, but that they're not the same, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Wow, that's a lot of work, but awesome. I can understand how that would work, especially in your genre, you know, because there is so many things you could put into a prequel or, you know.
Yeah. But I think you could do it with a lot of a lot of other genres. Like I know epilogues are a major thing in romance, for example, deleted scenes. Or like
the wedding scene, the first baby.
Exactly. Like there's, I think, endless possibilities with stuff like that.
Again, I think I really like picking up what you said. As you're writing, you're keeping a note, a little bit like your series Bible at the same time as you're working.
Yeah.
Just a quick note.
What could be,
Like a, you know, your flashback. I think that's a really clever way of doing it rather than sitting afterwards thinking,
Yeah, exactly, and having to come up with it from scratch.
No, it's a fantastic idea.
Yeah. I mean, all these sorts of things are things that I've developed over the course of, you know, 5+ years of writing. When I did the prequels for the Oromir Chronicles series, I very much just sat there one day and went, oh, now I've got to write a short story. What's it going to be about? Whereas now I think I've streamlined a lot more of my processes and I'm all about trying to make it as easy as possible for myself because I was actually listening to your episode this morning about multiple book projects, I think. Mm-hmm. And that's also something I talk about in the nonfiction book because even if you are only writing one book at a time of your series, in all likelihood, you're managing other stages of production, you're managing marketing and stuff. So all of these little things that I do, like keeping a series Bible, keeping like an idea dump folder for prequels and stuff, just helps make things easier. It's like one less thing I've got to manage and sit down and actively try to come up with ideas for stuff. I think it was really relevant listening to your episode this morning because that's where I'm at as well, just managing not only now different series but different genres. Like I've got nonfiction and fiction and that's a whole another kettle of fish again. I'm all about making it as streamlined as possible.
With your reader magnets, are they available to your newsletter list? Do you have them up on Amazon or are they just available?
I don't have them up on Amazon. I send them to my mailing list. So at the moment, at the back of all my books is a sign-up form to get the Curse of the Siren Queen prequels. One of the interesting sort of business decisions I made was with the Oromir short stories, eventually I put all of them into a collection of short stories. So there was the original nine, and then I think I added seven more and made a prequel collection of short stories, which is for sale on Amazon. But that's meant that I've had to take all those prequels out of email subscriber automations and things. And I don't think I would do that again. That, I think, was maybe a mistake. but it's done now. Whereas the Siren Queen Origins, they're just available if you sign up at the back of the form. If you're already a subscriber, I send them out as I've finished them. So one of the things on my never-ending to-do list is to create the prequel novellas for the new series, which will hopefully be launching next year. So then that'll be a matter of when Curse of the Siren Queen ends at the end of this year, then at the back of that book will be the prequels for the next series. And it's just the best way I can say it is you literally just taking the reader by the hand and saying, follow me, please, and just, you know, getting them to come along with you.
Exactly.
Pretty awesome. Yeah, yeah, really. And great. And
they'll be, they'll want to be there, right? Like, this is,
I hope so.
You're not like dragging them. This is no, like people who want to come with you.
No, they want more. They just, people always want more. Them. If they're loving a book, they'll always come back for more.
And yeah, all of and us leading as them readers to the next.
Yeah,
have felt bereft when a series ends, haven't we? And it's like, oh no, now what? And so what you're doing is just saying, well, here's what.
Softening the blow a little bit, yeah, I think, as well. Yeah. And particularly if you do opt to keep things in the same literary universe, that softens the blow again. So you get a freebie that brings you from this series to the next, and it's set in the same world. So it is familiar, and it's not as harsh a, you know, thing to go into something brand new cold, if that makes sense.
Yeah, makes total sense.
Awesome. Man, that's great information.
Yeah.
My head's spinning.
To stop Wendy's head spinning anymore, we'll wrap it up. But have you got any final pieces of advice or anything that you think is
apart from when all it's available gems, buying Helen's book,
How
to Write a Successful Series, which contains all of this plus a whole lot more.
Yeah, a lot
big
more
topic.
It's been very interesting, like trying to contain it just to this interview. Like because it is so all interlinked, I get, when I'm speaking about it, I do get a bit frazzled. I'm like, oh, I've forgotten this thing. But it's just this huge, huge topic, isn't it? But in terms of advice, Sarah Rosette has a fantastic book, How to Write a Series, and hers is a lot more about the different types of series. And so I think that's a really good starting point to sort of understanding the mechanics of a series, the different types of series. So she talks about dynamic and static, as do I, but she also goes into the different types of protagonists, multi-protagonists. It's a really good starting point. And the other thing I'd say is, if you're going to write in a series, you have to read series, and you have to, I mean, we do a lot of that anyway, even if it's watching a TV series, that they're using a lot of the same techniques, and maybe read or watch series and start to take note of the different devices that they're using. And if you can take some of that away and bring it to your own work.
Awesome. Awesome bit of advice.
Okay, so if someone wants to find you and read your books or find out how to get your new nonfiction book, where can they go?
So you can go just to helenshoira.com. My nonfiction is actually published under Helen B. Shoira, but I think there's not that many Shoiras. You'll probably be able to find me.
Spell it quickly.
S-C-H-E-U-E-R-E-R. So I'm at the moment, I'm keeping all my fiction and nonfiction under the same website, just because it would have been just too much to do multiple websites and things. I am offering a successful series bundle, which is you can actually get my complete series Bible from Curse of the Siren Queen to look at as an example of how to set your own up. I think what else is there? There's like a word tracker counter thing. There's a table of how to sort of manage multiple books in a series. So you can get all that for free on my website. I think it's helenshoira.com/4authors. That's the best place. And I'm on Instagram, Amazon, and I'm probably most active on Instagram, but I think that is more of my like fiction, lots of pretty book pictures and whatnot. If you sign up to get the successful series bundle, then you hear from me pretty regularly with like lots of advice and tips and tricks and all of that stuff. So that's probably the best place.
Awesome.
And where can we be found, Sha?
We can be found at spargirlspodcast.com and we can be found on Patreon at patreon.com/spargirlspodcast. And we just want to thank everybody that's joining us on there and welcoming you to our community, little hub of happiness. Well, mostly happiness sometimes.
Bad day.
Sometimes I have the odd rant, but yeah. But thank you so much for everybody for your support. And thank you, Helen, for returning to the spa.
Yeah.
No, it's always fun. Thanks so much for having me.
Awesome. Well, thank you all for listening.
Yeah.
Thank you all for listening to this episode of the Spa Girls podcast. We'll be back again next week. But for now,
keep well.
Bye. Bye.